Welcome to Masterclass. I'm sure everybody has either watched or heard about Masterclass at this point, I would hope. You all know the rules. You get called by your name and then you present. If you're not here and you miss a Masterclass, I hope you have something to make up, because if you miss more than once, you might have a issue graduating. Okay. Let's go. Who's first on the list? Is that Adama?
Yes.
Okay. Take it away.
Right. I'm gonna present on my phone because I'm still kind of at work. Give me one moment. It's loading up. Oh my God, I have to get out the meeting. Yes.
Okay, we'll move on to the next person while you get your stuff fixed. Just message me and let me know, okay? Is Larry here?
Yeah, I can
Okay.
present. No worries. Hopefully
Fantastic.
that'll. All right, let's see. Share. Present. Present in Teams. Present. Okay, can everybody see this?
Yep.
Okay, awesome. Okay, so I'm going to be doing my presentation on computer viruses, and I'm just going to go over a bunch of details about them, so I hope you guys are excited. Okay, so first of all, I just want to cover what is a computer virus? So, a computer virus itself is just a program that basically just makes copies of itself and does whatever you program it to be on the computers as it does. So it can it, most of the time it's like remaining dormant on the computers until somebody actually tells it to do something. So you shouldn't confuse it with like a worm, which in a different sense is something that copies itself on its own without the need of an input from somebody. So the term virus is oftentimes mistaken with the same term of malware, which it's kind of been interchanged for a long time, but there is a difference in the actual definitions of what they are. And I just thought that that would be important to cover because you're always going to hear somebody say, oh, like that is a antivirus software or anti-malware software. So, okay. So that's just right here. I'll go over just the more specific stuff about malware and viruses, where malware is just a general term for software that is created with the intent to do harm to any tech, like a computer system, a network, things like that. So a lot of the people, just as a preface, there was a lot of people that were unfamiliar with technology and cybersecurity in the original beginnings of all of this stuff, and they kind of interchanged the terminology. But malware is actually that general term that can cover things like ransomware, spyware, trojans, worms, and viruses are more specific, where it's so I showed some examples here where it's a boot sector virus, a browser hijacker, direct action virus. These are all like very specific types of viruses that have been made in order to hijack or penetrate the systems, and then from there they do their own things. Here's the history of computer viruses. So back in 1982, this is the first recorded, I guess you could say, computer virus, which was later on named Elk Cloner. And it was actually created by a 15-year-old, which I find insane, named Richard Skrenta. It was a virus that spread using floppy disks. And what it would do was you would put in a floppy disk into the machine that is infected. The machine would actually copy the virus onto that floppy disk, and then that floppy disk would then move on to infect other machines. The actual virus itself wasn't harmful in the sense that all it did was display a poem on the 50th boot of the machine. So you restarted the machine 50 times, and then it would show you some kind of poem. In 1984, Fred Cohen actually coined the term virus for the computer viruses. And then in 1986 was the first recorded malicious virus named Brain, which was actually created by two Pakistani brothers. Could not find out which brothers they were. I'm sure that somewhere it's hidden. I couldn't, but that's all that information that I could find at least. And Brain was actually one of the viruses that gave rise to all the people that were creating antiviruses right away, because people could see that it was a huge potential risk to many countries and the entire world. Okay, so moving on to the actual impact today. Today, obviously, as we all know, malware is at an all-time high. Everybody has multiple devices throughout their homes. Everybody has an iPhone. Everybody has a TV, a computer. So there's a lot of data and a lot of devices that could be hacked and gotten into. The more common types of malware would be ransomware, phishing, spyware, not as much like just general viruses used today as more complex systems, I guess you could say. And I had just listed here that under the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, you can find a lot of weekly reports on vulnerabilities and like monthly, weekly, daily new viruses that have been found in software, and it can help you stay safe. Okay. And my last and biggest section is just AI. Now being integrated with viruses can be a huge risk, but also a huge benefit. It just depends on how you're going to use it. I think, you know, with AI being used for an antivirus software and being implemented on all networks, on firewalls and whatnot, will be a huge help to a lot of companies to stay safe. But also at the same time, the attackers are going to be using AI integrated in their scripts when they are creating viruses, when they're going to be attacking with ransomware, all that kind of stuff. So I think down at its core, it's going to come down to just a AI versus AI constantly fighting against each other. And it's like, at which point is it even humans fighting at this point? And I guess it's already kind of been that since it's scripts and automated software that fights each other. So it's kind of been that way for not too long of a time. Okay, and here's just my reference page. Wanted to say thank you for everybody for listening. And if there are any comments, questions, concerns, that would be awesome. Cool. I think we're good. All right. Thank you.
Great job. Amada, do you want to go next? Take it away.
All right. Sorry about that. I'm trying to share my screen. Not letting me. Okay, there it is. Start with this. Okay. Are you guys able to see my screen?
Yeah, we can see it.
Okay. So, today I'm going to discuss something different from everybody. I know everybody's doing like information technology, AI, and all that. Well, my career is with the military, and I am a signal support specialist. So I'm going to teach y'all about how to perform voice communications and operate SINGARs. So today's task, well, this is how we present in the military. We do task conditions and standards. So the task is to instruct and train fellow, not service members, but interns, how to perform voice communications and operate SINGARs to the standard. The conditions would be in a classroom setting with heat and AC. The standards is to execute the voice communication with proper radio etiquette and operate SINGARs with operation requirements. The risk is low, environment conditions I mentioned before. So now we're going to discuss the actual voice communication. On the picture on the right is the little hand mic, and on his back is the actual radio that we use to communicate in the military. So the conditions is that every member gets an operational radio, and they have to set the frequency. They will get a call sign information card that will have their position, their call sign name. And in this situation, the network is secure, so there's no authentication required. Authentication on a network when we are talking on the radio means that like there will be a challenge password where if somebody's trying to join the net, they have to get the challenge password correct. The NCS is the person that's controlling the radio traffic. So radio traffic can be seen from all over the world, all over the every country you can think of. The radio traffic can go through. So you can see the NCS as an emergency dispatcher, and they have to always remain professional because there will be generals and higher ups that are listening. A net call sign is all the call signs, which represent all the stations within the net. So the performance steps one, we get evaluated on this. So you have to be able to put in the frequency and the network on the radio. And then you have to make sure you follow the little call sign or the mission requirements, and you respond to the NCS that's issuing the call. And make sure that you're using proper radio etiquette and you answer it in alphanumeric sequence. And this is an example. So you would be like, net, this is echo, tree, echo, over. And then they would repeat that and then their call sign. And then also, we don't use regular alphanumeric sequence. There's a specific way you have to say it. It's like 0, 1, 2, and so on. And this is the phonetic alphabet that we use. It's Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, and so on. It's just the alphabet we use to represent certain letters. And then there's radio etiquette. We don't like talk normal sentences. So like if you want to repeat yourself, you would say, I say again.
you kind of dumb it down so there's not like a long radio traffic. These are examples like Roger, that means like you understand. And then these are more examples. Break, like you're done. And then you can also send messages through these radios. You have to make sure that the net is clear, so try not to interrupt anybody. Make sure if there's a priority or an emergency that you are contacting the right people on the network. And then this is what I just explained. And then also you have to leave the network correctly. So the NCS, the person who's in charge of the radio traffic, will let you know when it's going to get closed down. This is just an example. So something that's important that you should know, what the NCS is and what their purpose is, which is the net control station is responsible for all the radio traffic. Another one that you should know if you are performing radio communications is the maximum number of people on the net, which is as many as the operator, as the operation needs. And that's how you would get evaluated. You have to make sure you're doing the right alphanumeric sequence. You send the message very concise, and you leave the net correctly. And these are references like the soldier warrior skills. It has more information on how we communicate through the radios. So now we're going to discuss about the actual radios that we use. The waveform we use is SINGARS, which is single channel and airborne radio system. On the bottom right corner is the actual like screen of the radio. There's the display, the little keyboard where you put the network. The networks be like FM stations. So it could be like 555 or 3 point something. Anything that everybody's using, make sure you're using the same one. You can change the channels, and then you can connect the little hand mic. They're pretty old. And then the top picture is how it actually looks like, the little radio. They're very old, but effective. It is VHF and FM. It is able to transmit and receive voice and data. It has like 2,320 channels between 30 to 88 megahertz, which is really good. It's able to operate in a hostile environment through the ECCM, which is the electronic countermeasure. And like I mentioned before, the voice and data is very good for support of the command and control operations. So with these radios, we can talk to people from across the country. And then terminology, the SINGARS I mentioned before is the single channel ground and radio operating system. The command net radio is just the single channel voice and data radio. The ANPRC is just the Army Navy portable radio communication. And the unit SOI is the unit signal operation instructions. The TM is just literally a technical manual where it shows you the instructions of whatever the item is. And then you get that SINGARS radio, and you have to be able to operate it in single channel mode. SINGARS, like I mentioned before, single channel ground and airborne radio system. How many channels and frequency? It's 2,320 channels between 30 to 88 megahertz. And then these are the performance steps on how to properly do the SINGARS. So you have to do the starting procedures. You load traffic encryption key. These radios have encryption inside of it, and you can load the actual tech inside with an SKL. And so if somebody doesn't have the encryption key, if you talk to them on the radio, it'll come out as muffled because they don't have the encryption key. So you have to make sure that everybody on your team that you're trying to communicate with has the encryption key, or you're not going to be able to decipher anything that they're saying through the radios. Make sure you know how to enter the network, which is easy. Everything's given to you. And then conduct a secure communications check. Just make sure that you can hear whoever you're talking to. You prepare for a control monitor for operation. You can change the radio functions using the control monitor. So you can change it from channel to channel. There are different channels. So you could talk to different networks on different channel, depending on who you're talking to or what country you're talking to. And this is how you would get evaluated. Make sure you load everything correctly, enter the network, and you change the radio functions. And make sure you zeroize it before, like, when we end and stop using the radios, you always make sure that you zeroize it because just for security reasons. And then these are the references that you can look up to know more about these radios and how communications work. This is not just for the Army. It can be for any branch, honestly. Every branch uses it. Is there any questions?
You zeroize green gear when you're done with it?
What is it?
You zeroize green gear when you're done with it?
Yeah, you can if you want to, depending on where you're securing it or like your instructions. But most of the time we zeroize it and get everything out of it.
Oh my God. I had no idea.
Cool. Yeah.
When you're, so for people who don't know, zeroizing in most military equipment destroys it. That's why I asked.
Yeah.
Who's next? Brisney's not going to be able to do it right now. Dominic Mora?
Yeah, sure. I can go. Give me 1 second to get prepped up here. Did you like present in Teams when you got the presentation out, or did you just like share screens?
Who, me?
Mostly asking the other people who did the presentation, like Cal Vates specifically presented it.
You can present in any way you want to, as long as people can see what you're doing. Sometimes if you're sharing audio, you have to make sure to go in and share audio. Other than that,
give me 1 second here then. Let me go ahead and get it pulled up. Okay, and let me share here. Let's see here. Can you guys see that?
Yep.
Okay, cool. Alrighty. So my name is Dominic Mora, and my masterclass presentation is on the history of mobile phones. To start, we should probably discuss what sorts of devices will be included in this presentation. In order to keep this masterclass from being over 40 pages long, there are two restrictions placed on the inventions being discussed today. First, the device in question should be made as the first invention of its kind, never been made before. However, if this was the only restriction, this would exclude reinventions that shape the course of the future, such as the telephone or the iPhone. As such, these improvements upon existing inventions are also valid as long as they're also the first in their line. This masterclass will be covering over 200 years of mobile communication history, covering a storied history spanning from the invention of the telegraph to where we are today, as well as a small glimpse into the future. We'll be exploring some leaves in the evolutionary tree that you most likely didn't know existed. For example, did you know that the iPhone wasn't the first touchscreen phone? Or even the first phone to be controlled with your finger? Because before researching this topic, I definitely didn't. But before I get ahead of myself, let's take it back to the beginning. Without going as far as smoke signals or messages delivered by men on horseback, the first electrical means of communication was devised in the 1700s, known as a telegraph. This was made possible by multiple combined inventions. To name a few, the invention of an electric battery in 1800, the creation of the first electric motor in 1821, and the development of the first electromagnet in 1825. The telegraph used these inventions together to send electrical impulses through a wire, All that was left was the creation of a language that could be understood by humans on the receiving end of the impulses. There were developments in England using their telegraphs to move needles as a form of communication, but in the United States, Samuel Morse instead focused on developing a form of the telegraph that could be heard rather than seen. Through long and short electrical impulses, an alphabet was born in 1835, and by 1838, Morse presented his communication concept to Congress. While he wasn't the first to invent the telegraph, he was the first to get political backing and boast a business model as well. In 1843, a telegraph system from Washington, D.C. to Baltimore was built, and in May 1844, the first message was sent, exclaiming, "What hath God wrought?" Following the invention of the telegraph, Alexander Graham Bell was responsible for the telephone. Working in conjunction with electrical engineer Thomas Watson, they aimed to improve the electric telegraph by making it easier for those on both ends to communicate. The premise was pretty simple. Instead of sending code from one person to another that requires an operator to translate, why not speak in both languages that both already understand? This led to the development of the acoustic telegraph, which would transmit the human voice over a wire. Despite not having a working telephone yet, Bell had filed for a patent in February 1876 for transmitting vocal or other sounds. Bell had eventually shown a working prototype in 1876 at the American Philadelphia Centennial. The Bell Telephone Company was founded in 1877, which would later become what we now know as AT&T. In the 20th century, communication devices began to lose their wire tether and gain mobility. This trend started with pagers, which were also known as beepers. These were first invented in 1921 and used by the Detroit Police Department, but it wasn't until 1949 when the first telephone pagers were developed and patented by Al Gross. These telephone pagers were initially used in New York City's Jewish Hospital and were not intended to be used as a consumer device. Pagers were mostly used for communications between emergency responders, including police officers, firefighters, and medical professionals. In fact, it took nearly 10 years for the FCC to approve the pager for public use, which was done in 1958. This led to Motorola developing a personal radio communications product a year later in 1959, although these never found commercial success until the Motorola PageBoy in 1964. The pager continued to evolve and is even still in use today with emergency responders, as pagers do not get bogged down by modern cellular network congestion and provide instant and reliable communication in any disastrous events. While the invention of pagers made wireless radio frequency communication a possibility, a similar invention called a walkie-talkie was also shaping the future of mobile communications. The actual identity of the inventor of the walkie-talkie is debated, with the honor being attributed to either Donald Hings or the Galvin Manufacturing Corporation, known by us now as Motorola. Hings was the first to make developments towards a more portable radio device, with his first recorded test being done as early as 1930, broadcasting devices distinctly between a plane in the air and a telegraph operator on the ground. This eventually culminated into the C-58 in 1937, which was meant as an emergency voice communications device for geologists and pilots. However, the godfather of walkie-talkies that we're familiar with is courtesy of a joint effort between the Galvin Manufacturing Corporation and the U.S. Army, which began as the SCR-300 in 1940, which is what's pictured up here. This is the backpack transceiver that earned the name walkie-talkie, with the apparatus shouldered on someone's back and a traditional phone grip for someone else to facilitate communication. A handheld device called the SCR-536 was developed in the same year. This was called the Handy Talkie, which was a more portable version of the other one, although the moniker Handy Talkie never caught on. Any subsequent evolutions have adopted the smaller handset size while being called walkie-talkies. These handheld devices were found in police cars in 1941 and deployed on World War II battlegrounds around 1943. The walkie-talkie, like pagers, are still in use today and continue to evolve over time. Motorola continued to lead the charge in evolving the walkie-talkie, utilizing something known as specialized mobile radio, which was an analog wireless technology allocated for two-way radio systems by the FCC in the 1970s. When cell phones began to gain prevalence, Nextel worked with Motorola to develop a digital version of SMR in 1991, allowing Motorola to include walkie-talkie functionality on devices that were not analog. Nextel also developed a network for this digital version of SMR, which was called IDEN, short for Integrated Digital Enhanced Network. This took advantage of existing GSM infrastructure, providing two-way digital radio service, wireless phone services, texting services, and data services at 96 kilobits per second. This eventually shut down in 2013, but the 800 megahertz spectrum used by IDEN was repurposed by Sprint to incorporate into their LTE spectrum. Speaking of Sprint Cellular Network, we should probably take a step back and discuss the development of a cell phone, or at least the concept of a cell network. As we previously discussed, two-way radio phones had been in use by the police and the military before World War II, although they had their limitations, especially as it relates to the range at which two people could communicate, especially also with the limited spectrum people could use to communicate. Aiming to remedy this, Bell Labs was experimenting with the concept of a cell network in the 1970s. This network would be made of hexagonal cells, each cell containing a base station that compatible phones would connect to. Adjacent cells would operate at different frequencies to avoid interference, and phones would switch frequencies as they moved from one cell to another to avoid clogging up different parts of the radio spectrum. This resulted in the Bell Labs Advanced Mobile Phone System, or AMPS, at the end of the 70s, which you and I may know better as 1G. The first handheld phone for this 1G network was developed by Martin Cooper, who was an engineer at Motorola. The prototype was first tested in 1973 and weighed about 2 kilograms, even heavier than the production version that we know of today. The consumer version of this phone was the Motorola Dynatac 8000X, which was released for the public in 1984. Even after 9 years of development and refinement, the phone still weighed over a kilogram, which earned it the nickname The Brick. Even in 1984, this phone was reserved for the wealthy, with an asking price of $3,995, which is the equivalent of over $12,000 in today's money. Despite its immense weight and eye-watering price of entry, the Brick is still revered fondly as one of the first inventions that brought mobile telephones to the general population. After the invention of the mobile telephone, subsequent improvements focused on giving the phone more functionality. The first phone to be considered a smartphone was the Simon Personal Communicator, which was announced by IBM in 1992 and released in 1994. This phone relied on a stylus to operate the screen, and for a business person in the mid-90s, this phone could do everything you could ever want it to do, notably the ability to send and receive emails and the ability to use a calendar and an address book. While touchscreen devices were implemented in 1994, it would take a few years for them to trickle down into the more mainstream devices. Notably, 2 years after the release of the Simon Personal Communicator was the Nokia 9000 Communicator, which was the first cell phone with internet capability. Despite the phone having the ability to connect to the internet, the actual viability of accessing the internet was limited due to extraordinarily high prices set by internet operators at the time. Like many of the inventions in this presentation, this phone suffered by being ahead of its time. On the topic of being ahead of its time, the first smartphone to have a screen that could be controlled by your finger was the LG KE850, which was also known as the LG Prada. This phone was announced in 2006 and launched in 2007 as a collaboration between LG and the fashion company Prada. This phone came out before Android's inception and was announced before the iPhone. So it was built on a proprietary flash operating system, which was viewed as being half-baked and unintuitive even at the time. As an example, despite this phone having the ability to recognize your finger as an input method, the keyboard used on the phone screen was T9, short for text on 9 keys, which, to the unaware, was the method of typing where you'd hit a certain number on a 10-digit keypad a number of times to select your letter, such as pressing the number 2 a total of 3 times to select the letter C. As this was a collaboration with a luxury fashion brand, the price of the phone was also incredibly high at the phone's launch, costing the equivalent of over $1,300 in today's money, which nowadays would get you the best possible iPhone even after tax. And speaking of the iPhone, this is the device that took the world by storm and redefined what we consider a smartphone to be, with its influence still felt today 17 years after the fact. Apple was already a successful company before the launch of the iPhone, with their MP3 players known as iPods and their computers known as iMacs being household names. The iPhone was marketed as all of these products combined into one, functioning as a cell phone, iPod, and computing device that fits in your pocket. The phone also had a capacitive touchscreen using your finger to control the interface, but unlike the LG Prada, it used a QWERTY keyboard, which is the keyboard layout that we're familiar with, at least for keyboards meant for the United States. The iPhone could also connect to existing 2G networks and was a device exclusively sold by Singular, which we now know as AT&T. The iPhone wasn't without flaws at launch. For example, the first iPhone had no app store, no ability to change your wallpaper, and the camera lacked a flash for low-light situations. The original iPhone launched at a price of $499 and $599, which in today's money is surprisingly close to the iPhone 15's launch price of $799. Serving as meaningful competition to the iPhone's cult following, hardware for a new operating system known as Android was developed by HTC. The resulting phone was known as the T-Mobile G1, or the HTC Dream. This phone was announced in 2008 and was technically the second device designed by the Android team. The original plan was to launch a BlackBerry-style device with the full keyboard underneath the screen. But after the iPhone was unveiled in 2007, the original device design had to be scrapped in order to compete with Apple. This device was also not without flaws. For example, while the phone supported email functionality, it couldn't synchronize this information with computers, nor could it synchronize any sort of like calendar or contact information. Reviews of the phone were mixed, although T-Mobile did consider the phone to be a success, reporting that in April 2009, over a million G1s were sold, accounting for 67% of the devices on its 3G network. As smartphone evolution began to stagnate in the late 2010s, manufacturers looked to other creative means of developing new form factors. From this, the concept of a foldable smartphone was born. The core fundamental of a folding phone at the time was to have a regular smartphone when you needed it, but when unfolded, you could have a tablet when you wanted it. The sales pitch eventually boiled down to a tablet that would fit in your pocket. The first foldable smartphone was created by a small company called Royole, which released a phone known as the FlexPi in 2019. Royole's main priority was being the first company to push a foldable smartphone to the market, and in their earnest to be the first, cut a significant number of corners. Namely, the software on the phone was notoriously buggy and unfinished, and the hardware reeked of compromise. Most smartphones have a touchscreen protected by glass, but the problem with glass is that it doesn't bend. In order to make a screen that can actually bend for a phone, the screen of the FlexPi was made of plastic. However, since plastic is a bendable material, it scratches significantly easier, and since the phone folded along the exterior of the phone, the screen was on the outside of it, the phone would get scuffed and damaged very heavily if it were inserted in a pocket or laid flat on a table. The second foldable smartphone to hit the market was a Samsung Galaxy Fold, which was announced a month after the Royole FlexPi with a slated release date of April 2019. The phone had two screens, one of which was an outer screen protected by glass, and the folding screen was along the interior of the phone, protected when the phone was folded shut. Overall, this phone was significantly more refined than the FlexPi, but only for a couple of days. After being in the hands of reviewers, Galaxy Fold devices were breaking at alarming rates, with each review device breaking in a different way. For some, the pixels on the inner display died along the crease. For others, debris entered through the gaps of the hinge into the crease. Most commonly, reviewers attempted to peel the top layer of the screen off of the phone, assuming that it was a screen protector and not an integral part of the display. In the wake of the negative media attention, Samsung canceled the Fold's launch and refunded any pre-orders. After taking a few months to work out the fatal flaws in the device, Samsung relaunched the Galaxy Fold in October of 2019. There were various improvements made to the durability of the device. First, the top layer of the screen now extended underneath the plastic bezels, so people wouldn't accidentally peel it off. Second, the gap around the hinge was reduced to help prevent debris from entering the body of the phone. And similarly, a metal layer was installed between the hinge and the screen to stop debris from being directly applied pressure to the screen. Additionally, Samsung promised Fold owners a one-time inner screen replacement at a discounted rate of $150. For a device that retailed for nearly $2,000, the phone was too plagued with compromises to be directly recommended to consumers, but Samsung is still producing Folds to this day, with each year resulting in fewer durability compromises. This begs the question, what are manufacturers working on next? Obviously, companies like Apple and Samsung are tight-lipped on what information they plan to share about their upcoming devices, so we can't conclusively see what the next evolution will look like. However, both companies have filed interesting patents and shown off bleeding-edge concepts that provide a peek into what could be coming next. Notably, Apple is developing an under-display camera array that would work underneath the glass of the phone. The sensors needed for Face ID and for the camera would be behind the glass. The patent mentions a digital filter that would be applied to captured images to reduce distortion, with a dedicated processor focused on differentiating between an image captured for facial recognition or for a picture just for the sake of having a picture. Rumors place the under-display camera to arrive in 2027, with the Face ID technology being the biggest hurdle for Apple's engineers, which obviously the 2027 date isn't confirmed by anyone. It's just rough figures there. Now, under-display cameras are nothing new. They've been developed in cell phones for years at this point. In the Americas, the most notable implementation of an under-display camera can be found on Samsung's Z Fold 4 and Z Fold 5 devices, where the pixel density of the screen is reduced above the camera to allow light to shine through. In the Asian market, there are devices that have under-screen displays that can see through a normal display without the need to lower the pixel density, although the quality of the pictures leaves a lot to be desired. There's a lot of evolution that still needs to take place there. Apple is also developing a foldable display, similar to Samsung's Z Fold and Z Flip series of phones. Apple's patent specifically aimed to correct the cracking found in modernist foldable displays, which is a common issue plaguing Samsung's brand of ultra-thin glass devices specifically. Apple's patent aims to correct this cracking through a foldable display with a higher hardness and tensile strength, as well as an outer protective layer that can sustain more strain before fracture. Samsung is also developing a display that can be folded in addition to being extended. This is made possible with the extended part of the display being rolled into the body of the device. While future devices most likely would not bend and extend, the demo shown is merely to show the flexibility of the display in question. More likely, this would result in either foldable phones with stronger displays or a new type of phone that is extended when you want a larger screen and rolled back when you want a smaller device. That was a lot to cover, so I thank you all for your time and willingness to listen. Are there any questions? Okay. With that was the whole thing. These are all the works cited. I appreciate you guys for listening.
That was fantastic. Who do we have next?
I think I'm next. The other Dominic.
Gotcha. Okay, you want to go?
Sure. I mean, that's a hard act to follow, but let me give this a shot. All right, everybody see my screen?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Good evening and welcome to my presentation about single sign-on. What is single sign-on? Single sign-on is an authentication method that allows users to sign in using one set of credentials to multiple independent software systems. Using SSO means a user doesn't have to sign in to every application they use. It also makes password management simpler for both the user and the organization. There are a number of options when it comes to SSO, which include both on-premise as well as cloud-based solutions. One on-premise option is Identity Server 4, which is an open source solution that we will briefly touch on as an option, but we'll focus more on cloud-based solutions, particularly Azure B2C. Note the founders of Identity Server have since created a company called Duende, which is still free for dev, testing, personal projects, and companies with less than $1 million in annual gross revenue. Other cloud-based solutions include Auth0 and AWS Cognito. Let's start with the disadvantages of SSO. Why would one not want to implement SSO? If an attacker gains access to a user's SSO credentials, they can gain access to every app it is connected to unless MFA is enabled. It can require specialized knowledge to implement. It can be costly and time-consuming to maintain. And a bad implementation can be really bad for an organization. For example, user X logs into SSO, but due to a bug in the SSO code and/or logic, gets claims for user Y. The application thinks that the logged in user is user X instead of user Y instead of user X. This is particularly bad if user Y has elevated permissions to the application that user X should not have. Not only does this look bad for the organization, but it could also present a serious security risk. Another example is what happens if an IDP you are integrated with changes their claims. This could cause an error on your SSO and would require updating your configuration. There are whole organizations that specialize in authentication solutions. Next, we'll talk about the advantages of SSO. Why would an organization want to spend the time and resources to implement SSO? In most cases, it will be the same login user experience across applications. Once a user is logged into one application, they are logged into all the connected apps. Users have fewer usernames and passwords to remember, which leads to decreased password fatigue. Users are less likely to have easy-to-guess passwords, and users are less likely to write down passwords on post-it notes kept under their keyboards. It also provides simplified password management for administrators. There is one place to reset a password, disable an account, or unlock an account. And finally, you can also enforce common password policies across all the applications. This includes MFA, password complexity, and password expiration. Let's look at a scenario for an organization that does not have SSO implemented. While he's with the company, John Smith has to set up his network credentials as well as register different usernames and passwords for different applications. This can be particularly difficult on John if the applications have password expirations. And from the organization's point of view, if John Smith leaves the company, then it can be difficult to remember or even know all the accounts he set up. If the organization misses one or more of the accounts, then they could be at risk. Now, let's look at a scenario for an organization that does have SSO implemented. In this scenario, the user only has to set up their network credentials. The username and password go through the same login user experience to access all of the applications. If they update their password, it automatically propagates through to all of the different systems. From the organization's point of view, if the user leaves the company, they just need to disable the network login and the user will automatically lose access to all of the applications. The company can also enforce the same password policies across all the applications, which is good for compliance. Let's look at some of the available SSO solutions. Starting with Identity Server 4. Although the creators of Identity Server have moved on to develop a commercial product, it is still a popular project and used by many people. It's an open source project, and unlike the cloud-based solutions, Identity Server 4 has fixed costs. It is an open source project. It runs on on-premise gear. It can integrate with an ASP.NET membership SQL database for local logins, and it supports integration with external IDPs. Supported protocols include SAML 2, OAuth, and OIDC. Side note, it can also be deployed in the cloud, which can be a good option for organizations that want to control the technology stack and code, combined with the availability and scalability that comes with being on the cloud. Next, we look at Auth0. Auth0 is a cloud-based identity platform that provides solutions for authenticating and authorizing users across applications. It simplifies the process of implementing and managing authentication and authorization. It does run on the cloud, supports local logins with credentials stored on the Auth0 tenant, and supports integration with external IDPs. Again, supported protocols are SAML 2, OAuth, and OIDC. Note, Auth0 is free for up to 7,500 active users. Next, we have AWS Cognito. It is an AWS cloud-based solution that comes with the scalability and reliability of AWS. Like Identity Server and Auth0, it supports SAML, OAuth, and OIDC integration for external IDPs. This brings us to Microsoft Azure B2C. Microsoft has a number of identity solutions, but B2C is their SSO solution that integrates with external IDPs. It supports the same protocols as the other SSO solutions we have talked about today, and is backed by the scalability and reliability of Microsoft Azure. As you can see, integrating B2C with a .NET API is actually not a lot of code. The first block is added in the startup.cs or program.cs file depending on the version of .NET you're working with. We're going to ignore .NET framework because that's the redheaded stepchild these days. The second block just requires adding the authorized decorator to the endpoint or controller. There's a little more to adding it to the UI side in this case, a React single page app, but it's not that bad if you're familiar with React. When testing registrations and single sign-on, it is helpful to be able to create disposable email addresses. Testing updates to the process can take numerous attempts, and trying to maintain hundreds of real email addresses is not a realistic option. Trust me, I've tried. Demo time. This is always an adventure because you never know what might go wrong in a live demo. We will start with the Azure B2C tenant. Hopefully you guys can see my browser window over my presentation now. As you can see, Azure B2C has its own section within the Azure console. The app registration section is where you link your different apps to your single sign-on solution. The identity providers is where you can link to different IDPs. Keep in mind, these pretty much only apply to the user flows. The user flows are the basic sign up, sign in, reset passwords, paths that you can create and manage in the UI, but give you extremely limited functionality. Which, if you need more powerful or more flexibility, That requires going to the custom policies, which they call Identity Experience Framework. So, to give you an idea of what that looks like, the policies are XML-based. It starts with the base policy, which is provided by Microsoft, and they highly recommend not updating this policy. On top of that policy sits the localization policy. This is where you can create different translations for your login, sign-up, sign-in screens. If you want to do it in different languages, this is where you would put those different text. On top of that sits your extensions file. This is where you have all your custom claims, your custom UI, also has your journeys and your external IDP integrations. This gives you a lot more flexibility than using the user flows. Now, if we go back, I can actually demo what this looks like. What you'll notice is I'm not actually signed in, but I'm going to sign in with the same username and password that I used to sign into all my computers, including my Azure account, my laptops, even Mac. You can integrate with local AD and sync out to a Azure Active Directory. From here, if you notice, I can now go to another app. And I am logged in. And if I go back to original app, I can go to yet another app, which again, the only reason why that selector comes up is because I'm logged into multiple accounts in Chrome. But if we want to actually look at the claims, we can actually see what is getting passed from the Azure AD through B2C and to the application. On the bright side, nothing crashed during my demo. Here's a visual of the flow that I just demonstrated. And of course, when it comes to logins, having detailed logging and error tracing are available is nice to have. And it's available through Azure App Insights. We want to take a quick look before I end this, what that looks like. You can actually see the process, you can see the integrations, and you can see how it's integrate going back to through your user journey. Any questions? I think.
All right, that was really good too. Who do we have next on the list? Let me check. Kyle?
Hi, can you guys all hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Right, awesome. I will go ahead and share my screen. All right, can you all see that?
Yeah.
All right, just a heads up, I have been sick all week, so if I have any long pauses, you might need to just kind of bear with me for parts of this. But yeah, I'll just go ahead and get started here. So my presentation is on Google's PageRank algorithm. So just to jump right into this, search engines that were popular before Google, such as Yahoo, ranked their pages based on the keywords used in the search and their placement and frequency in pages on the web. This was not ideal, however, because if I were to search for the phrase, say, Microsoft back then, instead of Microsoft's website being one of the top search results, it was possible for a web page containing only the word Microsoft thousands of times to appear more relevant. This led to some problematic results where website creators would add popular search terms and phrases to their website despite them not being relevant to the web page's content. This practice of overloading web pages with lots of different keywords led to poor search results, but thanks to those at Google, they had a solution. When Google went online in the late 1990s,
yes.
I think my slides are off. Oh, never mind.
I don't have the keys or anything. You're gonna talk to mom about that. I'm in a meeting.
I think someone's got a hot mic, it sounds like.
Oh, that would be me. My bad.
That's no problem. So yeah, when Google went online in the late 1990s, one thing that set it apart from other popular search engines was the fact that it was more likely to deliver the good stuff that users were looking for up front. When using other search engines, it was not uncommon to need to browse through pages and pages of results in order to find the website that you were looking for. Much of what made Google's search so effective was the use of its developed PageRank algorithm, which essentially ranks the importance of the pages of your search results. This allowed Google to present the most important results first, and those were usually the most helpful and relevant to the user's search. Search engines must be capable of three basic steps: web crawling, indexing the results, and figuring out which of those results are the most relevant. Web crawling essentially seeks out what pages exist on the web. Because there is no centralized database of all websites on the internet, Google has to seek out websites with every search. This also is sometimes called URL discovery and uses recently visited pages as well as links from popular pages to make the search. This process of crawling billions of web pages is done using huge systems of computers at Google. Indexing involves Google's search trying to understand what each page is about. This step evaluates the text content and HTML tags, such as title elements, image alternate texts, and more. The third stage is what this presentation will primarily be about. It is important for the search results from your search to be relevant. Google's algorithm takes all of the indexed search results and ranks them in order by their importance and relevancy to what was searched. The algorithm works by considering all web pages from a search plotted as nodes. Each website can give out one point of importance. The number of links to a page determines its overall weight, and pages with more links to them are weighted greater. Using this approach to give each website an overall importance score effectively ranks the importance and relevancy to the web pages in your search results. So, for an example of how this works, let's consider the entire internet being just four websites. In the image here, links between websites A, B, C, and D are represented with arrows connecting them. Consider each website as having one point of importance to give. So, since website A only has one link, it would give its entire importance point to website B. Since website B has two links to other pages, its single point would be split into two half points, giving half an importance point to website C and half a point to website D. Website C also has two links, so it will also give half an importance point to websites A and D. And finally, website D will give half an importance point to websites A and website B. Now, these values can be organized in a matrix to allow for computations to be done. Each website will be assigned a row and column of the matrix. Column A will contain the values that website A gives out to each of the other web pages, as well as itself. So the values of 0, 1, 0, and 0 can be populated into the matrix, since site A only gave one point to site B and has no other links to any of the other pages. Site B gives one half of a point to site C and half a point to site D, so we can continue to fill in the matrix. Again, pages that are not linked to get 0 points from website B. The C column can be filled in with the half point to website A and the half point to website D. And finally, the D column can be populated with its half point to website A and a half point to website B. The columns, you'll notice, will all add up to one, since each website only had one total point to give out, but the rows will give out to the total number of points that each website received. So, in this case, website B has received the most importance points, with its points totaling 1.5, websites A and D tied with 1 point each, and website C received the lowest score at just half a point. However, this is not the complete algorithm, since the PageRank algorithm also applies a weight to the links based on the importance of the website that contained it. We will see that even though websites A and D received the same score from this step, they will not be ranked equal. The reason why each page was given 1 point out, the reason why each page was given 1 point to give out is because it is essentially acting as a probability that a link is clicked. In the case of website A, it only has one link, so clicking a link at random would have a 100% chance of arriving at website B. From here, there is a 50% chance of arriving at website C and a 50% chance of arriving at website D. Continuing to repeat this step will lead to the determined rank of each page. Essentially, each number in this matrix represents the probability that a particular link is clicked at random. If we continue this pattern, certain pages will be linked to more often than others, leading to their links being weighted higher. This video does a good job of explaining the following calculations, so I'm going to play a part of that now.
If we spent a long time randomly clicking links, assuming equal time intervals between each click, what percent of that time would be spent on each site? Those percentages, which we'll add to 100 or a decimal value of 1, will be the rank of each site, and we'll put those values in a ranking matrix called R. Now, to begin this internet search, you have a 25% chance of just picking one of these websites, kind of like our initial ranks. But now let's find the probability of landing at any given site after just one click. To do this, we're going to take our 4x4 matrix and multiply it by the initial ranks or probabilities. As many of you know, to multiply two matrices, you multiply rows by columns one at a time. Remember, this first row is all the points given to site A, or the chances of getting to A from any given site. So this dot product tells you the probability of being at A after one click. Think about it. This says you have a 25% chance of starting at A times a 0% chance of going to A from there, since it doesn't link to itself. When you start at B, same initial probability, there's also no chance of going to A because there's no link. But if you start at C and pick a link, there's a 50% chance you get to A, and the same thing with site D. These are all the probabilities of just going to A from any site. So when you add those up, you have the total probability of being at A after that first click. It just so happened to stay the same at 25%. When we multiply the next row of all the probabilities of going to site B by our ranking matrix, we get 37.5%. Since everything was the same except you had that higher probability here of going from A to B, the final probability was, of course, higher. For the next row, we multiply and get a value of 0.125, and then the last leads to 0.25. These tell us the probabilities of being at each site after the first round of clicks. But I said we have to find the probability of being at each site after doing this for a long time, meaning we have to keep going and take our original matrix of probabilities, then multiply by this new ranking matrix to get the probabilities after a second round. One thing you'll notice is that the probability of being at C is actually higher now. And that's because in the last round, you had a higher chance of landing at site B, and that itself links to C, so that probability went up. Then we just repeat taking these new probabilities or ranks and find what they'll be after a third click, where the numbers finally start to separate a bit. After many, many multiplications, aka a lot of clicks, the probabilities will converge to these values here, and these are the ranks of each site. We see that site B is ranked highest as expected, and C is the lowest. But also note that site D ranked higher than A, even though they both had two incoming links. By the way, another way to look at how we got these is we took our 4x4 matrix that I'll just call A and multiplied by those initial ranks. We then took that value and multiplied by matrix A again, then we did that again and just kept repeating. So really this was just A to the N times R. As N approaches infinity, the product reached an equilibrium of our final ranks. So now if we spent a long time
All right, so what that showed was the process of repeatedly multiplying the matrices results in a convergence to a unique vector. This vector, when multiplied by the probability matrix, results in a scalar multiple of itself, which is also known as the eigenvector of that matrix. This emerges as the matrix's linear transformation starts to stabilize. Despite websites A and D both receiving a single point of importance, website D ranked higher than website A. This is because website D was linked to by website B, which ranked the highest overall. It is not only about the number of links leading to a web page, but also about the quality of the links. A link from a website like, let's say, Microsoft or Apple's website is going to contribute to a higher score than a link from a lesser visited website. Over time, more precise probabilities can be observed from users clicking certain links more frequently than others. As more and more of this data is collected, the probability matrix can be adjusted, which should yield a more accurate overall page ranking. Google collects tons of data on its users, which help to contribute to this. So, circling back to when Google went online, its success was largely due to this algorithm, which was created using basic linear algebra techniques. The brilliance of PageRank lies in its simplicity and its ability to rank searches in this way, although being fairly straightforward, it was revolutionary at the time. The use of eigenvectors in the algorithm also acts as a great example of how mathematics can have a significant real-world application. So while PageRank was Google's original method for supplying relevant search results, When it went online, much of the algorithm is still used in Google searches today. However, it has gone through much refinement and is now part of a much more complex system involving many other factors in addition to the algorithm, such as location and previously visited websites. The success of PageRank also contributed to many search engine optimization practices, such as leading developers to realizing that not just content, but also the way at which information is connected on the web plays an important role in determining the visibility of the information to search engines. In conclusion, the use of the PageRank algorithm was a crucial moment in the history of the internet. It not only changed the way search engines operate, but also influenced how information is organized and accessed online. So thank you all for listening. Does anyone have any questions? All right. Thank you all.
That was incredibly detailed. I have Sheer Ryan next.
Yes, sure.
I don't know if I said that right. Sharayan? Okay. You ready?
Yes, sir.
Not a sir.
No. Oh. Sorry. Can everybody see my screen?
Looks good.
Yep.
Okay. My name is Today, I will be presenting artificial intelligence in the military. What is artificial intelligence? Artificial intelligence is a computer system that's able to perform complex tasks that usually only humans can perform. Artificial intelligence is an extensive field that covers many different areas, including data, analytics, statistics, software engineering, and neuroscience. So there's four types of artificial intelligence. Reactive machine, AI system has no memory and are assigned specific tasks. Limited memory, this type of AI system does have memory, which allows it to use previous experiences to advise future decisions, like self-driving cars uses this. Theory of mind is when social intelligence is applied to the system, allowing it to understand emotion. Self-awareness. AI systems have self-awareness, which will allow them to recognize their current state. This type doesn't exist yet. Military artificial intelligence. Artificial intelligence AI is used within the U.S. military to make leadership of all levels make better and timely decisions. Example of how AI is used within the military, it includes the finance system, payroll, recruiting, promotion, medical, and on the battlefield. The United States has been a global leader responsible for uses of military AI and autonomy for over a decade. Again, how is AI used in the military? Cybersecurity. The U.S. deployed artificial intelligence to analyze different cybersecurity technology to protect communication and soldiers. AI will help detect, process the information, and rapidly disseminate the information to forces on the battlefield, transportation of supplies, personnel through autonomous vehicles. Healthcare of U.S. military uses AI to help tend to service members on the battlefield and stateside with medical diagnosis through their healthcare history. Trainings and combat simulations help familiarize soldiers with military operations and combat systems. The use of AI helps leaders of all levels integrate several disciplines. The types of U.S. Army weapons using AI. Image target recognition systems, drones. The U.S. Army has one of the most advanced target image recognition systems in the world. The image recognition systems can spot various threats on the battlefield and warn about potential dangers. The U.S. Army integrate an artificial intelligence recognition, which integrates on various types of weapon systems like the M1 Abrams, which is the main battle tank within the Army. This system supports the advanced Atlas. The system helps enable warfighters, we call ourselves warfighters now, instead of just soldiers, to distinguish threats more rapidly that humans wouldn't be able to. Remote weapons is a remote operated weaponized system using the military vehicles to protect vehicles and occupants. The system is equipped with fire control systems for light and medium caliber weapons. How does AI military support decision making? Machine learning algorithms can quickly process the vast amounts of data to provide valuable insight to all levels of military leadership, support decision making in the military range from the battlefield to the boardroom of all collection of data. Artificial intelligence machines have the power and capability to make timely decisions by using AI software to predict outcome. It protects civilians and soldiers on the battlefield. So the future of AI in the military. AI systems must be accommodated both AI and human as users of the system. When data transfer, endpoints create opportunities for skilled adversaries to target militaries using AI system. So the U.S. just has to enhance cybersecurity technology through AI. What is very clear is that warfare will be dependent on technology enhanced with AI and logistics, intelligence, and machine-operated systems. Here's my reference. Any questions? And I'm finished. I'm sorry, short. Okay. I just didn't want more in depth. Didn't want to get people confused because I know not everybody's in the military.
It was still good. You did a good job. Doesn't always have to be long to be what you're after. I have one more tonight. I really don't want to mess up your name. Brisney?
Yes, you said it correctly.
Okay. You're the last one on the list. Are you ready to go?
Yes. I'm going to share my screen. I'm having a little computer issue, so I'm going to use it on my iPad. So hopefully, you know, it goes well.
All right.
Wait. Why is it over? Okay. Let me go to my PowerPoint. Can everyone see that?
Yep.
Okay. So my presentation is going to be the military and technology. I know I've already heard some presentations of people being in the military, but I know there's some that aren't in the military, so I want to talk a little bit about myself and my job, and I'm going to explain what I do as a signal soldier and why the military should, in my opinion, take more advanced technology than all the outdated equipment that we have nowadays. So a little about myself. I am 22 years old. I have 4 years in the Army active duty, and I'm still hoping to do my full 20. I am the team chief / IT specialist for the control post node, which is a type of equipment we use for communication. I'll talk more about this later on. And I am currently pursuing my degree in information technology since my job in the military is information technology. It's, you know, it goes hand in hand. So what is an IT specialist in the Army? An IT specialist in the Army is often referred to as a cyber operations specialist or signal support specialist who play a critical role in maintaining the military's communication and information systems. So my job, personally, you can do a lot of things, but I got put into a unit where I work strictly in signal in the field and for missions. So we do cybersecurity operations, technical support, deployed operations, and lots of teamwork and collaborations. So for cybersecurity operations, we play a crucial role in protecting the military's network and information systems from cyber threats. This involves implementing security measures, conducting vulnerability assessments, and monitoring many networks for suspicious activity and responding to any type of incidents, whether it be something negative or something that we just don't know what it is. For technical support, we provide soldiers and units assisting them with troubleshooting issues related to computer hardware, software, networking, and anything that they may need either in the field or just when you're like not in the field, just doing your day-to-day job. In the military, no matter what job you are, you have to have teamwork and collaboration. And for us, we work with soldiers, we work with civilians, we work with just about anybody, other military members, when it comes to signal to ensure the mission gets accomplished correctly and efficiently. A signal support specialist. So what I work on at my job is a CPN, which is the command post node, which provides direct network access to users within a battalion.
I don't know if you can hear me, but I think we're losing you. We'll give her a couple minutes to catch up. Okay, so here's the deal. Masterclass doesn't close till 10. I'm going to sit on here till 10, so she has as much time to be able to get back as she wants to. If you've already presented, which everybody but her has, you don't have to stay here if you don't want to. It's optional. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it's going to get real, real boring here real quick. Unless you guys want to start talking. Because I'm definitely not the kind of person that's going to monologue. So, as far as the question about presentations, Masterclass is scheduled for everybody. Are you brand new? Von Terrace? Von Terrace?
How you say that's correct. That is correct, Von Terrace. Yeah, I'm new. This is my second week.
Okay, yeah, no, that's it. It's scheduled for you. There's an Excel document called the Masterclass Schedule. Check it to make sure where you're at. It's going to be in probably your week 8, 9, or 10 spot. Yeah.
Okay, I'll check that out.
Anybody do anything cool? Been done for like 3 weeks.
Just sleeping when I can.
Hell yeah. I got off school and immediately started working more at my job. And I was like, oh my God, this is for the birds. I need to find a soft dev job immediately. I don't want to do this anymore.
I got out of the army so I wouldn't have to work long days ever again in my life. And here I am.
Yeah, got out of the Marine Corps, same reason. I was like, if I wake up one more time and see the stars and the moon, I'm going to lose it.
Or have something crawling in your shirt to wake you up.
Oh, I had a snake in my bivy sack one time, out in 29 palms. I don't even know what kind of snake it was. It was the middle of the night. I got up and threw that sucker. I got in so much trouble because, you know, not a lot of mess with wildlife.
Yeah, I woke up with something in my shirt and I was so tired that I just sat up, crunched it in my shirt and laid back down. And then in the morning, I found out that it was like a cockroach that had crawled into my shirt.
Fantastic. So how many people here were or are in the military? No, I'm genuinely curious because I feel like it's more than half of them. I mean, there was a few other people that were talking about it earlier.
I'm sorry, I don't know if my presentation cut off or.
Oh no, you guys,
welcome back.
Huh?
You cut all the way off. We were waiting for you.
Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh, I kept talking because my thing still said that I was on it, so I just kept talking. Oh my gosh, okay, I'm so sorry. Let me connect again. I'm so sorry.
You were on the slide with the soft top. Jesus Christ, why can't I remember the name of it? The troop carrier with the soft top on it.
I don't know why it's not working. Your screen.
Thank you.
I don't know why it's not. Why isn't it broadcast? I don't know why it's not sharing me. I'm sorry, I'm having difficulties. It was sharing perfectly fine and it said it was going good, but it's not
working. We got we got till 10 o'clock. We'll figure it out. We got people to, like, we're just BSing over here. It's fine.
Okay. Yeah, let me.
Are you in the field coming back right now? Like, what's up?
I'm currently, I'm currently, like, I'm taking school, but I'm on leave, but I'm still working. So it's just like, I'm in between, like, school/work. So yeah, but I'm not in the field. It's just, I'm having lots of trouble. There's always bad connectivity on base.
Yeah.
For some reason. That's just not going to work.
I live in Camp Lejeune area in Jacksonville, and when I was on base, I couldn't get more than 50 megs. I moved off base, and I live literally like 100 yards from the base gate, and I get 300 megs, so, or 300, yeah, so.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, base is awful.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, I think it should work now. I'm sharing my screen. I don't know if it's
oh, yeah, you gotta pay for that crappy internet that you can download a movie in 3 days. I'm still not seeing anything.
Yeah, I don't know. Oh my gosh. Okay, this is
I'll tell you what, send me your PowerPoint or on Teams, and I'll open it up on Teams and share it from here, and we can try to do it that way.
Okay. Please work.
That Afghanistan internet, though, you know what I'm talking about? That satellite internet that isn't really satellite.
Absolutely.
Like an aluminum. Yeah, that like aluminum foil dish that they have in the middle of, like, in the sky, and they're like, this is a poor excuse for interwebs. Oh,
it's working.
Yeah, we can see your screen.
Okay, so I don't know what slide I left off on.
Keep going. Keep going. One more. No, wait, was I wrong? Go back one. Yeah, that one. Because I was staring at one of them being like, what the heck? Yeah, I think that's it. Okay.
I'm just going to go start over on this slide just because I don't know exactly where I left off or where it cut off. Because my screen was perfectly fine. It was like, it was still rolling. Okay. So I am a signal support specialist, and that is a MOS, which is a job in the military. Our job could either range from working at an S6 shop, which is just troubleshooting and helping at like an admin job, or you're a signal specialist where you work with the CPN, which is the controlled post node. My job is I work with the CPN, and the CPN stands for command post node, which provides direct network access to users within a battalion element. It utilizes Ku-SET satellite or HCLOS connectivity. It has permanent links to the hub node and the JNN, and can establish on-demand connections to other CPNs within the networks. The CPN is housed in several transit cases, which include NIPR, SIPR, voice, and as well as other elements. If you look at the picture, at the second picture in the bottom where it says KU-SCT, those are the stacks, the types of stacks we use. We connect to ASCT, which is like a satellite that connects to the bird, which then sends a signal for us to provide services for a battalion level. Next slide. So for us, for this, I can't really go much into detail because it's confidential, and I just don't want to say too much, but we have different stacks, which is SIPR, NIPR, and colorless, and with these stacks come with the computer, and when we do that, we are able to connect. We are able to get services, like let's say we're like in the field and we have like no connectivity, no internet, no nothing. We're able to get services to be able to access the internet, to access our emails, or be able to access ways to communicate to other people if we are somewhere where we have no connection, no way of communication or anything like that. So that's basically what we do in the field. So the military technology and why we should advance has various has various positive things that that will come out of it. But since the military is a little on the stingy side when it comes with money, we are slowly updating technology, but not as fast as I think we should. If we do update technology, such as things as the CPN, we will maintain strategic advantage, enhance operational effectiveness, and adapt to evolving threats. So right now, everyone I know, I'm pretty sure sees the news with everything that's going on around the world. But if we were to advance technology, warfare is constantly evolving. And with adversaries employing new tactics, technologies, and asymmetric strategies, advancing military technology enables armed forces to adapt to emerging threats such as cyber warfare, unmanned aerial vehicles, and hybrid warfare, ensuring readiness and resilience in the face of evolving challenges. The pros in which we should enhance our technology is enhance efficiency and effectiveness, strategic advantage, adaptability to emerging threats, and cost savings in the long run. The number one cons for advancing our technology in the military is security. Security is the number one reason why people in the military don't want advanced technology, just because if we were to go back and you will see right here, these are the stacks we use when we do field operations or where we're in a deployment setting or anywhere where we have no signal. We use these stacks, and these, for one, are really heavy. They're a two-man lift. They're about 80 to 100 to 120 pounds each. They're hard to set up, and they're really, really tricky. It took me almost 6 months just to learn how to properly turn on, turn off, and set up this correctly without any issues. The number one reason why we have so outdated material is because the military wants to keep that security and that threat away from people knowing what we do and how we do things, which we understand. Yes, it's a good thing that not everybody knows how to use these, but it also does not benefit the military, in which if something like this were to break or need maintenance, it takes such a long time to get it fixed, which if we have something that's more technologically advanced, it will take a few seconds to fix, do a few calls, you know, fix something behind the screen, this and that, will be easier to fix. But number one reason why military hasn't really advanced technology is due to security. All in all, I feel like the military should advance. I feel like there's more pros than cons. However, the military is here to defend the nation, and the number one threat is security, and that's why we have so much outdated technology. But in reality, I feel like the world is evolving. Everything is becoming cyber. The military should move along with the rest of the world in order to ensure effectiveness in everything we do. The resources I used was General Dynamics, which is one of the main brand of equipment that we use for signal, I guess, for signal. The other links I can't really post since I can't really disclose some information like that. Before we go into questions, I do have some pictures you guys want to see from our last mission. The first picture is of the satellite that got set up in the field in Australia with our generators. And I didn't take a picture of our equipment because I'm not allowed to, but that's just the morning picture. It was like around 5 a.m. The second picture is just me with the kangaroo. You know, we were in Australia and they were just everywhere. And the third picture is us setting up the HECLOS in order to validate, to have communication with other elements that were not that far away from us, but just to make sure that we were able to communicate. And that is all. Is there any questions?
I have one question.
Yeah.
On slide 6, you said they were called stacks, like the big green cases. Are those essentially just like huge, like computer cases in a sense?
Yes. They're just huge computer cases. They just have like, they're so outdated. So like what you have in your computer right now, like in the personal laptop, is everything that's in there. It's just everything's so old, everything's separate. Like you have like your power, a whole different section than what you have with to connect your ports. Everything's just separate. So that's why they're in a big case. But it's essentially like a computer, just everything has its own component.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Any other questions?
How were the kangaroos?
Oh, they were nice. They, I had food, so you feed them, they don't really do anything to you. And I was petting them, so. Okay. Thank you so much for listening to me and going through all these technical difficulties. I really appreciate it.
Good job.
Thank you. Not to stop sharing my screen. Okay. Okay, thank you.
All right. Fantastic. I'm pretty sure that's the end of Masterclass, unless there's any random presenters that are going to show up. So I'm going to go ahead and stop the recording. Thank you, everybody, for showing up. Have a good night.
Good night.